Good morning, everyone, and welcome. I'm Kelly Thorpe from Maricopa, Arizona, USDA ARS. And my co-authors on this work is Dr. Welch and Dr. White, who you heard from earlier in the session. Abhi Lamsal is a grad student of Dr. Welch's, and Dr. Holland, who I don't know, but provided the data for the work that I'll be describing. As many of the other talks in the session, this one also is in the vein of field-based high-throughput crop phenomics. So this is all review for you, but what we're interested in is connecting the phenotypes with the genotypes of different crops. We want to understand how genes control complex traits such as time to flowering, yield, drought tolerance, things like that. And so, as scientists, we're developing many tools, some of them related to sensing, some of them related to computing, so that we can conduct the data collection and analysis that needs to be done to solve this problem. One of the issues is that tens of thousands of lines need to be grown out, need to be monitored, and so we're talking about big data. As such, there will be a role then for advanced computing technologies to be applied to this. Sensors are inherently limited because they only measure at one time point, or they only measure a certain quantity or characteristic. And so the thinking is that we can combine sensor data with models in order to expand the number of phenotypes that could be collected, and I'll provide some examples. Where we're headed is that the parameter estimates of these models through model inversion could be the additional phenotypes that we are interested in analyzing. So high-performance computing will have a role in this. Specific objective of my talk here is to describe some high-performance computing techniques that I've implemented with the DSAT cropping system model, and particularly to invert the series maize model to estimate parameters that control maize anthesis. So first I'm going to take you through a few examples of model inversion. Some people call it inverse modeling. I've heard reverse modeling or model inversion is the one that I prefer because in some papers that I've tried to publish, reviewers have commented that inverse modeling means that you can actually mathematically invert the equations of the model. We're not doing that here. We're taking our physical models and we're simply backing out the input parameters to them through a variety of different approaches can be done for that. This example here is for ProSale. Typically our models are developed such that the system that we're trying to model has some particular attributes that we provide to the model as input, and then something that's observable about the system is simulated by the model. So in the case of ProSale, the model takes as input parameters like chlorophyll A and B, or the leaf area index, leaf water content, and simulates a canopy spectral response. So in any phenotyping case, we'll be measuring this piece, the spectral response, with our reflectance sensors. We want to use models then to back out these traits that could be used for the genetic comparison. So in a forward modeling case, we know these things, and we just plug them in and we run the model and we get our output. What we want to do is the reverse. We call that model inversion. Here's another example. Let's say we have cotton plant height date, cotton plant height measured on several dates over the season. We can fit a simple differential equation to that data, and I think Jeff might have showed something along these lines earlier. What this does is that it provides additional parameters. For example, the R parameter that's part of this model could give you some information about the stem elongation rate. We're not measuring stem elongation rate, we're measuring plant height, but we're using our models to back out a parameter that may be informative about the rate at which stems are elongating for a particular variety. So this is the advantage of inverse modeling and where we're headed. The third example here is the one that I'm going to spend the remainder of my talk on. The data for the example comes from the MAIS NAM population, or the Nested Association Mapping population. This population contains over 5,000 lines of maize, and they've been grown out in 11 different environments. And many things were measured, and thesis date was one of them. We also have our DSAT cropping system model, or the series maize model, which simulates maize development and growth over time. So the model can respond to temperature and photoperiod factors in the environment. The model requires several different parameters, hundreds of parameters actually, but we're going to be focusing only on five in this study. These five parameters are the ones that govern the simulation of maize flowering, or time from emergence to flowering. And it's a daily time step model, so these calculations happen on a daily basis. Specific goals for the model inversion study then were to use the measured anthesis data from the maize NAM population experiments to invert the series maize model and to estimate these five parameters that I mentioned, which control the time to flowering in the model. Then, after this process happens, we can use these estimates of the parameters in the genomic analysis to try to identify what genes in the varieties are responsible for anthesis, time to anthesis. To solve this problem, we turn to high-performance computing. And so the Texas Advanced Computing Center was mentioned in an earlier talk, and we're using that system here. The name of the supercomputer at TAC that we're using is Stampede. It's a Linux system, uses CentOS, and these are some of the specs on that machine, but it has over 100,000 processing cores. So according to this website, the machine is, you know, pretty high up in terms of ranking about the size or speed of the computer in terms of comparing it to other supercomputers in the world and in the country. Here's a picture of the machine here, and that's me and Dr. White over here. We visited TAC, which is in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas. We visited there last year for a group of crop modelers came together to learn how to use the machine for their purposes. So step one in this analysis would be to prepare the series maize model input files. Again, I mentioned we have 11 environments here, two years at Homestead, Florida, 2 years in Urbana, Illinois, 2 years in Columbia, Missouri, 2 years in Clayton, North Carolina, 2 years in New York, and a final year and 1 year in Puerto Rico. Each of these studies have different planning dates, so we have our 11 management files where we specify what the planning date is. And within each of those files, we include 998 treatments. And those different treatments are just different tests of the different five parameters. Okay, so we have this is basically a packet or one job on the machine where we have our planning date specified and we're testing with one job 998 different parameter combinations. We also have we need our weather data. So we have 11 different weather files where we specify the Tmax and Tmin and solar radiation data that were measured during the maize NAM experiments. To modify these weather files was append constant weather at the end because we wanted to make sure that that regardless of the parameter combination that we tested, that the line or that particular parameter test would actually mature a crop. So what that means is that you will get some ridiculous values for maturity and anthesis state, but we can cut those out. The point of appending weather at the end of the weather data set was just to ensure that the model would actually finish the crop, enough heat units would be accumulated to finish the crop. We didn't have any soil files here because we're not simulating any water or nitrogen balance. The cultivar files for the model were actually printed during the run on the supercomputer because we calculate the cultivar parameters that we're testing on the fly. I mentioned that the supercomputer is a Linux OS, and so we did have to compile the DSAT model for Linux, and I can talk with you about that process after the talk if you have interest. The next step in the process was to define a parameter space that we are interested in analyzing. So this is a brute force approach to the model analysis. We're defining a range of 5 parameters, and we're trying to use the supercomputer to say how many simulations can we conduct within this 5-dimensional space in the allotted time. So we use a SOBOL sequence algorithm in order to choose the parameters to test along the way. This is a quasi-random sampling algorithm, and it is repeatable, which is why we chose it. You could go back and rerun it and actually test the same parameters in sequence again. The 5 parameters that we adjusted are listed here. P1 is basically a thermal time from seedling, it's from emergence to the juvenile phase within the model. P2 is related to photoperiod and how sensitive the cultivar is to photoperiod. The Fint parameter is basically the thermal time between successive leaf tip appearances in the crop. T-base is the base temperature below which no development occurs in the crop. And P2O is the day length, below which day length doesn't have any effect on development. And here are the range of parameters that we chose for those 5 parameters. Next step was to design the simulation job on the machine. So the main constraint on Stampede is that each time you submit a job to the machine, that job can only last 48 hours. So my general strategy was to try to see how many simulations I could pack within that 48-hour time limit. From the start, we decided that we would run each of the 11 site years as a separate submission on the machine. So each site year would be allotted the 48-hour time limit to try to test the different parameters. And since we're using SOBOL, which is repeatable, repeatable parameter selection, we are ensuring that for each of these 11 environments, the same parameters will be tested over the course of time. To try to improve the efficiency of the model, we've done a few things to try to minimize I.O. We only output one file, so only the summary.out information was output from the model. Again, I mentioned that we ran these 998 treatments together in a chunk within one management file, and that basically has the effect of reducing the number of times you have to read the weather file. It only has to be read once for that set of 998 runs. We eliminated writes to the standard out. So this is the output that the model would usually write to the screen if you were to run it on a desktop computer. What we found is that information was being written to a log file on the computer, and we don't need that, and that takes extra resources, so we just cut that component out of the model. And we also turned off the water and nitrogen balances in the model. So these are the ways that we tried to improve the efficiency of the simulations on the machine. Another step was to identify the number of optimum number of cores to use. So the way the machine works is that no matter how many cores you select, it's going to give you a number of cores that's a multiple of 16. So it's always more efficient if you select a number of cores to use that's the multiple of 16. Otherwise, you'll have a set of cores that are sitting idle while your job runs, and your allocation will be charged for those cores that are sitting idle. And then the final step, again, to determine the number of runs that we could try to cram into 48-hour time limit. So to determine this, this optimum number of cores thing, I ran a quick test before we scaled up the job. What I did was I ran 998 simulations on a set of cores, and where I varied the number of cores that was used. But no matter how many cores I chose, I just ran 998 simulations on each of those cores. And this was the result. So we see that what's happening is this would be 16 cores. We ran 998 jobs on 16 cores, and then we boost that up to whatever the multiple of 16 here is, 150-something. And on up to 112 cores was where we peaked. This is where we optimized. So in this first part of the curve, this is where we're getting the advantage of using multiple cores. But we see that there's a limit. There's a point in time when choosing more cores to run your jobs on actually gets you a decreased efficiency or fewer runs per second overall. I don't know exactly why, but my anticipated answer for this is that I/O is still a problem with the models, and so we're hitting a limit here with actually trying to read from the hard drive on 600 and some cores is actually slowing the whole process down. And the final conclusion was that we ran all the jobs selecting 112 cores. The next step was to scale up, and so we did some calculations based on what we could achieve and determined that we might be able to get 32,465 jobs, each of those jobs containing the 998 simulations apiece, and get that to fit in the 48-hour time limit. This would equate to about 32 million simulations for each of those 11 environments, and a total of more than 356 million simulations overall. And the final step was to actually conduct the simulations and run the job on the computer. And that required three different files. The SLURM file is basically the file that's required to tell the computer that you want to run a job and you want to select the X number of cores and you want to have these particular constraints on your submitted job, like time limits and things. These other two scripts are just Python scripts that actually perform the tasks of the job on the computer. So we have run setup.py. It's a Python script that basically it creates 112 directories. So each core will run the model in each one of these 112 directories on the machine, linking the appropriate files into those directories, sets up a queue so that we can take the 32,000 jobs and partition them sequentially over these 112 directories, and actually launch the submission on the machine, and finally collecting the output. The runModel.py script, this subroutine is copied into each of the 112 directories, and it has the task of actually running individual simulations. So within here, we calculate the five parameters from SOBOL. We write those parameters into the cultivar files required by the model. We run a set of 998 series maze simulations, and then obtain the amphthesis state simulated output for each one of those simulations. So how well did we do? The plot on the left shows the total number of hours to complete the simulations for each environment. And so what you see, first of all, is that some of the environments went over the 48-hour time limit. So we kind of overestimated what we could accomplish for some of the environments. The reason being, I think, that if you look, this is Illinois, this is Missouri, this is New York. So the colder environments are taking longer to run, meaning it's a colder environment, so more days have to be simulated in order to get to maturity. On the right, you see the average number of runs per second. You see that all the environments are basically over 150 runs per second. comparatively speaking, I've never really been able to get more than, say, 6 or 8, 10 runs per second on a desktop machine. So we're talking a tenfold increase in speed by using this supercomputer. But there's potential for improvement yet. So I've conducted another study with the ProSail model that I mentioned earlier. And this was just a comparative study on how many, you know, runs I could get within a lot of time again, but with the ProSail model. The reason that I tested ProSail is because there's two different versions. One of the versions is a Fortran-based model that basically compiled with Fortran, and the way that it works is it reads one file with the input parameters for the ProSail model, and it writes performs the simulation and then writes the output reflectance data. So I ran this model on the machine, and I was able to do 40 million simulations with the ProSail model in 38 hours for an average of 290 simulations per second. But there's this other model that is a Python-based ProSail model. It's called PyProSail. And what it does is it actually encapsulates the original ProSail model for use in Python so that you can actually calculate, or you can run the model from a command line in Python. And what that does is it eliminates the I.O. There's no reading of input parameters from a file. There's no writing of the data to the output file. That step is taken out. All of the data exchanged with the model happens in computer memory. And if I implemented that model on the machine instead, I was able to do 3.7 billion simulations in 37 hours for an average of over 27,000 simulations per second. So you can see the potential of further eliminating I.O. from these models. So my conclusion is that there is potential to similarly encapsulate crop models in Python and drastically increase the number of simulations that we can complete in a given allotted time even more. Okay, so back to my analysis of the maize-NAM population data. So where are we now, and what do we have? For each of those 11 site years, we have observed anthesis dates for over 5,000 maize lines. Although I will say that some of the lines did fail to flower in some environments. So not all of the lines have 11 data points, which is a complicating factor in the data analysis. What we have is simulated anthesis dates for 32 million evaluations of 5 parameters from a crop model that control time to flowering. So now we can move on to the model inversion portion of the analysis. We want to identify the parameter set in the model that is best for each maize line. Which set of 5 parameters gives the best answer in terms of making a simulation from emergence to flowering? And so this analysis was conducted on a computing cluster at KSU. So the credit for the remaining slides go to Dr. Welch and his grad student Abhi for their analysis. So the point of the analysis was to determine the parameter set essentially that minimizes the error between the measured and simulated anthesis date. This is some results from that. So we have our 5 parameters. The histograms show the variability in optimum parameters for each one. And you see the correlation between the parameters. Interesting thing to notice is that there are these banding issues in a lot of the different plots. So I'll talk about that. But first, equifinality, and this was brought up in the earlier talks. Equifinality is a term that comes up whenever you've done modeling long enough. Basically, if you break the word apart, it means equal final. Okay, the final simulation results are equal, meaning that multiple parameter sets give the same simulation result. Well, it's not good. It's not interesting. If you think about the case in a 3D, if we had a 3D parameter case, your model response surface would be flat. So the parameter changes in the model are not given any variability in output, so the model is not very useful in that case. What we found here in this plot is basically when we did have 11 data points per line, the problem of equifinality was lower, say it was less, than say if we had only 6 or 7 data points per line. So there's some evidence that if we increase the number of site years, then this problem is less. Overall, for our 5,483 lines, only 20% of them exhibited equifinality. 11% of them had 2 parameter sets that were equifinal. 4% of them had 3 parameter sets that were equifinal. A few of them had over 40 parameter sets that were equifinal. This is a kind of an overall analysis of the issue of equifinality for this problem. Good news is that 80% of the lines showed no equifinality. So we have a single set of parameters that were optimum for those lines. More on the banding issue. So here's just a close-up example of 2 parameters, P2O and P2. These would be the optimum. What's shown here are the optimum values for the 5,000 some lines. And you see these bands. What is that? We don't know what that is. We haven't figured that out yet. Is this some kind of artifact in the model that's giving us these bands? Does this have some kind of biological meaning that we could learn something from? Results here are pending, and we're trying to develop some ways to cluster these bands in a quantitative way so that we could better identify what's causing it. It's a very interesting result. So in conclusion, high-performance computing has some advantages. It permits you to characterize the entire parameter space that you're interested in. This is in comparison to, say, optimization techniques, which are trying to efficiently move you toward an optimum value. We're not doing that here. We are actually characterizing the entire parameter space and doing the inversion step as a second and separate step. We've shown that high-performance computing can increase the potential number of simulations that you can do. However, the models that we have weren't developed for this. They have been developed to sort of pull our knowledge together and synthesize it, and they've been developed for desktop machines. There hasn't been a lot of effort to make them computationally efficient. So there's a lot of work that can be done in that area to make full use of the potential for these high-performance computers. In terms of model inversion, yes, equifinality is problematic. We're continuing to explore that issue with this particular data set and trying to identify causes for those bands that I showed. And finally, the genetic analysis. This is where the geneticists take over. They can take the parameters that we've been able to obtain from this inversion procedure and do the genetic analysis needed to identify the genes that are responsible for time deflowering. So that will come in time. Thank you.